Hi everybody, my name is Bob, as you can probably see. Good morning. I will try to keep it light and lively. As you can see, it's more or less an overview of what quantum computing was, is, and perhaps will be. We're not going to get into too much depth here. I do tend to forget to define some terms occasionally, so if I screw up something, just let me know. This is going to be tough. Starting off, probably a good idea to define a few things. First off, of course, quantum computing. Definitions of computer aside, to keep Turing from rolling in his grave, it is a computing process wherein a quantum system's superposition and entanglement is exploited. Now I'm about to define those two terms as well. It feels like a dictionary, doesn't it? Okay, this is going to suck. The concept of a state of a quantum system, really, we can talk about anything. We can talk about any kind of system like an electron. Electron has a quantity that we like to refer to as spin. Whether or not it's actually spinning is kind of a philosophical debate. But the physical, we are able to take measurements and able to define something as spin up, spin down. We can define that, we can make note of that and say, well, you know what, electron spin up, we could call that a 1, and electron spin down, we can call that a 0. We can talk about a system wherein an electron, without being measured, all things being equal, we don't really know what kind of spin it has until we measure it. And before we measure that spin, it is said to be in a superposition of states. It is said to be in all the states that it can. It will have both spin up and spin down. We measure the electron, we have a probability of it getting a spin up or a spin down. If all things being equal, it's generally 50% one way or the other. And here's the thing, if you measure it again, you're going to get the same probabilities. Once you measure a spin up, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get spin up next time either. So, it gives us a crapshoot, effectively, of what a system is going to spit back at us. Whatever we're measuring out of a system, we have certain probabilities of getting back information that we want. What is going to make this useful for us is a concept called quantum entanglement. Entanglement is the other half of this, how we make use of quantum mechanics for computing. It's the quality of linking two states together. Say two electrons have a state. Their superpositions of states are intertwined. We're able to gain meaning from this random result. And that was the crux. That's what started the concept of possibly using quantum mechanics for computing. We're able to take that random result and modify the input circumstances and do some hocus pocus and magic and get out the actual output result we're looking for. This concept of entangled pairs, of entangled particles, it originally came from a paper by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, and it's often referred to as the EPR paper. They describe certain EPR pairs, these pairs of particles. In their case, they said it was kind of a Gnocchi experiment, saying, you know, what happens here? They posed a paradox, and people came along later and said, well, that's not really a paradox, or, well, depends on who you talk to, whether or not they say it's a paradox, but. You imagine a neutral spin zero particle. It's got no charge. It's got no spin, as we like to describe it. In this case, like a pion. A pion is a type of elementary particle. It decays into two particles, an electron and a positron. You know, the positron's just the antiparticle of the electron. Both of those have spin 1/2. That's their basic characteristic, one of their basic characteristics. They must have opposite spin to conserve that quantity, to conserve the spin. There's a conservation of spin in that operation. What's the problem then? Well, they're also probably going to be having some linear momentum because there's leftover energy. It's got to go somewhere. It's going to get them moving. It's going to get them moving in opposite directions because there's a conservation of linear momentum as well. So these particles are moving back far and far away from each other. And it's possible to measure the spin of one and know precisely what the spin of the other one is before any kind of message can be received from where the other particle is. And that's what Einstein and Podolsky and Rolston said. Hey, well, we can't have that. We can't have information traveling faster than the speed of light. Well, we can, kind of. Whether or not it's actually usable or not is still kind of up to debate, I think. People in sci-fi have expanded on this concept for a while now, and I've read a number of books about instantaneous communication systems. But this concept of entangled pairs, pretty crucial right now for quantum parallelism or for quantum computing. Quantum parallelism is a phrase that's kind of bandied about a little bit in this field. I worked with Cray computers for a little while, and I'm not much of a computer scientist. My background's physics, but I did work as an analyst for a while on a Cray, and I know the difference between parallel and vector processing, more or less. Quantum parallelism isn't necessarily parallelism, in the sense that you can't do different operations on a set of bits at the same time. It's more like vector processing, where you have a register of numbers and you operate on all of those numbers at once. Scalar processing, you have a register where you hold one number and you have an operation, and maybe you have another register and you do an operation between those two, perhaps, and you end up with a third number. Vector processing, you have several of these, and it all gets done in the same time as it would in a scalar processor. It's just the vector processor, vector register holds more data, and it just all gets operated on. That's more like what quantum computing is. It allows you to run operations on a large number of states of a system in the same amount of time, effectively, as one state of the system. And the concept of this, there are a number of philosophical debates. Basically, it depends on which direction you came into the field from. There's a man I'm getting ready to talk to him about. His name is David Deutsch. He started in, he's in Oxford right now. Well, he has been in Oxford. He came up with the concept, really, of this in, I think, 78 or so. Tried to get a paper published, couldn't get it. I'll talk about that in a little bit. He likes the concept of this multiverse, of this multiple parallel universes. On the other side is the school of thought that kind of sprouted out of Richard Feynman, who talks about kind of a Hilbert space approximation. Hilbert space is... it's an abstract concept. It's basically a space of functions, and it's not important to go into it right now, but the point is that the difference between these two is minimal. It's really kind of the way you think about it. If you like to think about parallel universes, go right ahead. You know, every part where a spin of an electron could have gone down instead of up, it spawns a new universe. You want to think about that? Go right ahead. The math doesn't change. That's what's important. Concept of a qubit. By the way, these are just my notes. I put them up here to have a little bit of eye candy, and so you didn't have to look at me all the time. So, concept of a qubit. A qubit is what we describe in a quantum system for bit. It's how we describe a bit, a representation of a quantum system that is going to represent one and zero for us. Could be spin states of an electron, like I've talked about before. Could be polarization states of a photon. Y'all familiar with the way light can be polarized, like a polarization sunglasses, where you're cutting out half the light by having a polarizer in there, or you're confining the light into up, down, left, right, or whatever. You can use those states of a photon as a qubit to describe a quantum system. Reversible processes. This is a lot more tricky. This is the last definition I have here, and then we'll actually talk. 1973, a man named Charles Bennett from IBM Research really thought about it and said classical computation, it really can be broken down all the way down into a set of logically reversible steps. You do not have to lose information to be able to do a calculation, which, if it's logically reversible, we implement digital logic, so it allows us to in turn implement a physically reversible computation. Rolf Landauer was his mentor. I meant to go back and check. I'm not sure if this is the same Landauer as we see in a lot of other Landauers in physics, but he made the observation that for every bit of lost information, you lose some energy. And as an example of Pentium, per floating point operation, we'll lose 100,000 bits. I found that freaky weird. I didn't know that they would actually have to do that much to do a floating point operation, but I read that. I read it in a paper by a man from Southampton, University of Southampton, and I trust him, but woof, that's a lot of bits. Okay, why do we care about reversible processes? Well, when you can do a process and reverse it, a reversible process actually takes very little energy. Very little energy. If some of you have gone through basic physics and have talked about heat engines and Carnot cycle, and if the process is reversible, you actually use up almost no energy getting back to the point where you started. Quantum laws, the various laws governing quantum mechanics, are themselves reversible, meaning that as a state travels through time, evolves in time, the quantum laws still determine the probability of the system, this next one is kind of for anybody who's the true physics geek, I guess. They evolves through time. Still, it is still modeled by the Schrodinger equation, by all the quantum laws. Therefore, the process has to be reversible. And this is borne out by the fact that this Schrodinger time evolution operator is unitary, preserving the normal of the states of the system. Don't worry about that. Thus, to build a quantum computer governed by the Schrodinger equation, we have to use reversible logic, reversible processes. Let's talk about where we've been. Progenitors of quantum mechanics. David Deutsch from Oxford. He was the first one to talk about the concept of calculation being performed in many universes at once. 1978, he wrote a paper to the Physical Review, which is one of the primary journals in physics research, the primary, frankly, from a lot of people's perspective. It was rejected, because I'm not sure, but he's kind of like me. He pushes forth a problem and if it doesn't, you know, if he doesn't get anything back on the fishing reel, he kind of lets it go. So he kind of let it go until 1985, after Feynman had come out with a number of things on his own. Feynman, in 1982, it may have been 1981, I'm not sure, gave a talk at the Physics of Information Conference. I'm not sure where it was. He brought this concept of using quantum mechanics, using the principles of quantum mechanics to do computing. He has a couple of, well, he has one book called Physics, shoot, what is it? Feynman Lectures on Computation. If you've ever taken basic physics or even higher physics, he has Feynman Lectures in Physics that is a three-volume set, fairly monstrous, but he's the kind of person that, and I actually talk about him in my other talk on the hacker work ethic, he is the kind of person that really groks a problem. He really understands it, and therefore he's able to really explain it very well. And so I would suggest his books if you're interested. Both of these approaches, more or less fundamentally the same. You're talking about the concept of making an operation on all the states of a system at once, effectively. No talk about computer technology would be complete without a blurb about Moore's law. I put law in quotes there because it's a pet peeve of mine. It's not a law, it's a trend. It's an observation. There's no experiment really that really proves this law. But the crux of why I brought it up is by 2008, the current trend is that we're going to see devices operating on scale of using something like 10 electrons per operation, per 10 electrons per what transistor, per whatever, per switch. And we're seeing a backwards progression from classical to quantum. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. The quantum mechanics is based on a series of say a hydrogen atom, and you have an electron and a nucleus, and electron is in a shell around the nucleus. It can have certain quantum, you know, that's where the whole term quantum comes from. It has certain electron shells that it can be in. They're each described by a number, right? It's described by a quantum number. You put more and more molecules together, you get more and more numbers involved, and basically, as these states that are involved in a quantum system tends to go up and up and up and up and up and up, you start to approach classical mechanics. You start to approach an average value of the system, which is what is described by the laws of classical Newtonian mechanics. As you go backwards, as you start to strip away all of this, like we're doing now, as we're going back into using fewer and fewer electrons per device, we're going back into the quantum mechanical, well, we never got there, but we're moving into the quantum mechanical realm from the classical realm. The laws change. Well, yeah, they change. The quantum mechanical laws really encompass classical laws if you really have, you know, infinite computing capability over infinite time, you can model, you know, me with quantum mechanical wave function. But it's just pretty damn impossible right now. As you go back, we're seeing that these days. We're seeing quantum mechanical effects come into what are effectively classical devices. This is a point that Feynman made. There is no physical impediment to us doing this. Therefore, we should. Therefore, we can. The force driving it forward right now has got to be the incredible power that was put forth, that was hinted at in 1994, that quantum computing can be applied to cryptanalysis. It's Mr. Shor, 1984, came up with an algorithm, a quantum mechanical reversible process algorithm, to factor large numbers. Monstrous, monstrous speedups. We're talking age of the universe down to a few minutes, monstrous speedup. For a couple of years, that's pretty much all there was. Then a man named Grover came along, 1996, and came up with a fast searching algorithm suitable for databases or even DES. DES is a crypto system where you search a key space. RSA and so forth are the types of algorithms where you are working on a math problem that's behind the cryptography. Fast searching DES, you can reduce the time. It's not as much of an improvement. Order of square root over n, the square root of n over 2 versus the order of n over 2 in time. But it's good. It's worth it. Actually, I picked that up from Dr. Hayes' paper in Southampton 2, and I'm not that's a little bit too vague to make that kind of a judgment about Grover's algorithm. I would have to read up a little bit more about that. But anyway, where we are now, somewhere, it's hard to tell, but somewhere I think we're between Babbage and vacuum tubes. We're maybe getting into the vacuum tube stage. We're getting to the point, and I guess I'll make the point in a minute about hardware and software pairing. We're getting to the point where we're starting to. I've seen a couple of papers about them implementing Grover's algorithm, implementing Shor's algorithm. I don't know how large the computer was. I don't know how many qubits they used or anything like that. But I've seen a couple of papers. I know that there are that people have been doing research in the materials that you make quantum computers out of, and there are a number of competing materials, and I'll show you there, right down there with hardware research. And a lot of people are, research on quantum algorithms actually are tough in quantum mechanics and quantum computing, but the research on algorithms I think is lagging a little bit behind, so it's giving the hardware time to catch up. Nothing quite practical yet, obviously. HP and MIT did in 2001 form a partnership to, I believe, create a center for research in quantum computing. There's actually a startup company, which freaked the hell out of me when I found out about it, called Magic Q Technologies. The research groups involved, the main ones were Oxford, IBM Allendon Research, Caltech and MIT. I think we could have, just done a big duh there. But hardware research. What are the materials they're using? NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, now known in the medical industry as MRI because people didn't like the word nuclear. Basically, it's been described as computing in a test tube. You have a macroscopic globule of material that you stick in an NMR machine, and you pattern the field that it sees in very specific ways. And I'm not going to pretend to know that much about NMR right now. Vast numbers of molecules in the sample. The magnetic spin is the information carrier in this case. This is a very noisy process, but as I understand it, getting a lot better. The signal to noise operation is pretty bad. It is promising. It is exceedingly not portable. We're talking huge monstrous semiconductor magnets here. Switching time, the time that it takes a bit to go from 1 to 0, 10 to the minus 3 seconds approximately. Decoherence time, the time that it takes that bit to lose that data, that molecule, to lose lose the data, to forget about what it is. Maybe something on the order of 10 to the 4 seconds. Very good. Very good in this case, which is why people are working in NMR very much these days, even though there's a great problem with with signal-to-noise ratio. There's a great problem with forming those magnetic fields. It's very difficult, but this is what's drawing them there right now. This figure of merit is basically one divided by the other. T-coherence divided by switching. It's how many times you can switch a molecule in an algorithm, say. How many times you can operate on that molecule. 10 to the 7th, not that bad. Scalability, up to 10 to 50 qubits. You can hold up to 10 to 50 qubits of information. So it's decent. There's a good deal of research being done on this. Ion trapping, a little bit more difficult. You're trapping an ion with a combination of electrodes and lasers. Your switching time is significantly better, 10 to the minus 7. Decoherence time is significantly worse, 10 to the minus 1 or so. Ends up being similar figure of merit. Scalability is about the same, but from what I understand, a lot more difficult to pull off than NMR. Optical cavity quantum electrodynamics. I'm not even going to pretend to know the state of research here. I've not seen anybody using this, but I haven't gone through it exhaustively. Basically, you have a cavity where there is a light mode that's been excited, and there's an atom in there that you couple it to this mode. Sounds a lot like the movie Real Genius to me. There's switching time is freaking phenomenal, 10 to the minus 14 seconds. Decoherence time is worse, 10 to the minus 5. Very good figure of merit. Very poor scalability. 2 to 5 qubits, perhaps, in a single system that you can hold on to. Quantum dots. This is my opinion, but I haven't seen it refuted yet. Probably the best option for integrating with existing technology. We can make quantum dots out of semiconductors. We can make quantum dots out of silicon, gallium arsenide, whatever. The decoherence time is a killer here. You can see switching time is good, nanosecond. Decoherence time is bad, a millisecond, microsecond. Figure of merit, can operate on the poor thing about 1,000 times before you lose the electron. Most of the time you're looking at electrons here, and you're looking at the spin state of the electron, and the electrons are trapped in various quantum dots. Let me describe a quantum dot, I guess. Most of you take physics, I'm sure, and familiar with the potential and kinetic energy of a ball rolling down a hill, right? That well at the bottom of the hill is effectively a potential well. You have zero potential at the bottom and high potential at the top. If you can imagine that in two dimensions, you have a two-dimensional well that you place a ball at around the whole side, it'll go to the center. Three dimensions is a quantum dot. It's a little bit harder to think. If you're thinking about in people in space, it's maybe easier, but you have to have the ability to move in three dimensions, have an electron being, as it comes across this potential drop, it wants to sit in there. So that's what they're using for, that's where a lot of research is going into right now, it's quantum dots and dots and quantum wires, actually, which is a 2D and a long wire. Optical photon. You can actually do quantum computing with optical photons. It's good for studying the architecture. It's not very practical, from what I understand. The nonlinear materials that you have to use are very lossy. So, but it's good for studying. Going into software, software research. The connection between software and hardware so far has been very tight. The original things you did with vacuum tubes, they implemented a specific algorithm for a specific piece of hardware, and that's what it did, and you didn't necessarily change it. We're not making universal computers yet. What else do we have? We had 1994, we had Shor. 1996, we had Grover. What else? Well, actually, 1996, somebody proposed. In fact, I think it was Bennett or one of the other guys that are big in the field proposed the concept of fixing this whole decoherence problem with an error correction. Which, if it were a random process, I don't think would be possible. But the point is that these qubits, are entangled with the other things that are in the system. So if one, perhaps, goes through a losing of its data, you have the rest that may have information. It's kind of like a RAID array. You may have information about that one, and you can reconstruct. You can have fault tolerance built into the system. There is, as I understand it, I haven't seen it, a Fourier transform algorithm that people have created. I'm not even sure who it was, but there's the speed up is pretty phenomenal in itself. It goes from one level of complexity to another. The n times 2 to the nth down to polynomial time of n squared, which is pretty phenomenal. Where we are with quantum cryptography now. Okay, yeah. I stuck this in here. This is a slight tangent, but I'll try to get back. Cryptography, quantum cryptography, is a concept of using a channel, using a channel which is, I guess it could be called quantum secure, to transfer basically a series of bits which becomes a one-time pad. It came from the concept of this guy, as a grad student, had proposed this concept of quantum money, which was a bill with a serial number and a series of 20 light traps, which held a photon in one of four polarization states. Now, nobody knew what the hell to make of this and thought, oh, well, this is a very cute little idea, but nobody said anything. You know, it's like, oh, well, yeah. How the hell do we make something like that? So no, we're not going to bother pursuing it. But Bennett, the guy I talked about before, and another guy, Gil Brossard, came along. They determined how they could use this concept of polarization states of a photon to be used for communication. How it could save our secrets from quantum computing. Basically, it could. It could save our secrets from quantum computing. And the good news is, the research in quantum cryptography is a lot further along than quantum computing. So that's the good news. What it is, basically, it's basically a one-time pad crypto. If you're familiar with cryptography, one of the as I understand it, the only form right now which is guaranteed to be unbreakable is one-time pad. Where do I have it? I actually have it down here. No, I don't. Oh, yeah, there it is. It's a Hedron research. It solves the ass bane of one-time pad use. The key exchange from separated parties. You have one party, Alice, and you have another party, Bob. Me. You connect them with a system which allows Alice to send out single photons with not random polarizations. She chooses a polarization scheme where a photon polarized up means one, horizontal means zero, or forward slash, you know, you can be this way, or this way means one, and this way means zero. There's two options, and there's a crystal which you can stick in the light path, and it will make the photon that has this polarization move down and spatially separate from the photons which have this polarization. So you end up with two beams of photons. So you can differentiate between this and this. You cannot differentiate between this and this and this at the same time. It basically, she says, I'm going to rotate my crystal so that it's going to pop out photons that are either this or this polarization. And then for every photon that pops out, she can randomly change the orientation of the crystal so that it will polarize this way or this way. Bob at the other end gets these photons, and he's not in contact with her while she's doing this. He chooses a random orientation for his polarizer. It says, I want to measure this way, or I want to measure this way. So on average, he will be 50% wrong. He'll measure things. If a photon comes in with this polarization, and he's measuring it with a polarizer bent over like this, he'll get 50%. He'll get a 50% probability of measuring a photon like this or like this. It's, I'm not sure I can go into this very quickly, but basically when he has the polarization off, he only has 50% chance of getting that measuring the right bit the way she wanted it. So basically, half the data that they send this way is kind of lost. What she does, she sends him a little communique over free space, over clear channel. It says, I used these polarizations in this series of photons. He sends back getting her information, he sends back the information that says, okay, I measured this, and this photon correctly. He doesn't say what he measured. He just said that he measured them correctly because he has from her the fact that his polarizer was oriented the right way. Then he measured the photon that came out that way. He sends back the knowledge that these particular photons I measured correctly. So then they use that intersection, those set of photons that Bob sent back, so the first 50th, the 51st, and whatever photons, and that series of bits is used as a one-time pad. The one-time pad can be over clear channel; does not have to be over quantum channel. Now, why this is unbreakable. The quantum channel, there's nothing, there isn't anything to keep somebody, and the traditional person is to call them, the traditional man in the middle is called Eve, kind of evil, but we put Eve in the middle of this conversation between Alice and Bob, and Eve has no choice but to do the same things that Bob was, to orient this crystal so that she can see these various photons. Well, whatever she measures, she's able to pop out that photon to Bob. So he's not necessarily going to notice immediately that the photons are missing, or the photons have been intercepted, rather. But she will have a map of these photons. Now, her map is going to be 50% wrong. So the photons that Bob gets when he does his random orientation are going to be at least 75% wrong when they get to him. He's going to do his off of her probability, 50% of 50% down to 25%. Basically, it's what drives this is the fact that when you have a polarizer that measures photons that are vertical or horizontal, it only has a 50% probability of measuring them when you orient them this way, along the slashes, along the diagonals. And that's what drives this. It's interesting, but it doesn't actually have much to do with quantum computing, but it is kind of related. Okay, future. Where we were, where we are now, where we will be. When could it be practical? What could be practical for for database searching, for cryptanalysis, for weather prediction. Who knows? At this point, like I said, who knows? Back in the 50s, 40s, when we were making machines out of vacuum tubes, did we know that in 50 years we'd we'd have computers like this? No. We have no idea. It may progress slowly or quickly depending on funding that comes in. Most people back 4 or 5 years ago didn't think we'd have a 7-bit processor, qubit processor. But in March of 2000, they made one in Los Alamos. So there's already indication that it's moving a lot quicker than normal, than you might think. Socioeconomic impacts. Well, you know, what happens when we get a useful quantum processor that that can break RSA encryption, large number factorization encryption? Well, I don't know that much about encryption. I really like to. Does anybody know about elliptic curve cryptography? There's another branch called elliptic curve cryptography, and I'm not sure if it operates in the same large number factorization principles. But if it didn't, we might have a shot, at least for a little while, until somebody discovered an algorithm. But we're probably going to hit the wall with a one-time pad and a quantum key transfer. Quantum key transfer, I'm sure, will not be available to most people. So good luck. I'm not sure what's going to happen at that point. Maybe the cypherpunks will come up with something that we can use and protect ourselves against three-letter agencies. It will certainly help. There's a great deal of work that's being done right now in computational chemistry. Probably something like 75% of the cycles on supercomputers these days are done with computational chemistry, quantum mechanics. Drug discovery, that's in the same region, but optimization problems, anything where you have to examine all the states of a system and judge which is the best. Applications, who knows, plug-in card, quantum coprocessor. I doubt anything like that operates on a quantum process will ever be used for stuff like this. Never say never, but I can't imagine most of the processes involved it takes so much time to figure out how to do them quantum mechanically that I can't even foresee the possibility of an entire quantum computer being your desktop machine. Like I said, never say never, so who knows. The reading list, I'll go over a couple of parts of the reading list. There's a sheet on the back table if anybody's interested. It's a little half sheet of paper. Simon Singh wrote a little book called The Code Book, which is great if you're into cryptography. Half of it went over my head. I'm just kidding. There's a spot at the end, a chapter at the end about quantum cryptography, and it's very interesting. He describes it a hell of a lot better than I could. But it was information that was published in a New Scientist article. It was published in 1999 that he wrote. Gerard Milburn, Feynman processor. I think I actually have that with me, so you can see the cover. This is a very good. It's if you only buy one, this is the one to buy. Or if you only go to Barnes & Noble and read it while drinking coffee. It's very good. It's pop sci a little bit, but it's good level to read. A lot of practical information, a lot of interesting information. There is a book by Julian Brown who follows from David Deutsch. Actually, David Deutsch wrote the prologue to the book. One of the originals. It was originally published as Minds, Machines, and the Multiverse. It's now The Quest for the Quantum Computer. Good, but at a higher level. I'd buy this one second. If you are a masochist, Nielsen and Chung wrote a book called Quantum Computing and Quantum Information. it's meant for grad students, and I would have a background in physics and information theory to go into this book. Otherwise, it would just, it's put me to sleep many a times. I read in bed, so, you know, anything that's boring will just knock me out. No, it's actually, it is an exhaustive text, but it is a text. It is not PopSci at all, so. Let's see, there's another one called Physics of Quantum Information, which I believe is a amalgamated set of papers in the field. And the book I talked about before, Feynman Lectures of Computation, very good book, by the way. Only the last part of it has anything to do with quantum processing, but most of it is very applicable still to the quantum to the computing industry. He talks about the basic physics of storing information, the physics of operating in information. It's actually just fascinating. Some of the websites involved, Oxford Center. They nabbed up qubit.org pretty quick. They have a big group there working on quantum computing. Widely varied links are at this address from Berkeley. He's I think he's a grad student or maybe a professor. I'm not sure who the guy is, but he has a lot of quantum computing links. Very good intro from a guy named Dr. Peter Hay, I believe his name is, from the University of Southampton, which I mentioned him before. He's got a very good 5-6 web page intro on some of the basics involved. Again, probably a lot better than I did. Quantum simulation for classical computers. There is something out there that I actually have another book that I did not mention here. It's called The Explorations of Quantum Computing. Totally freaked me out when I saw it in 1998 at a supercomputing conference. It has Mathematica 2.2 and 3 notebooks, which you can run on your system and explore quantum parallelization. And there is a, let's see, there's link split over lines. I hate it when I do that. Lots of links at this guy, and here's that startup that I talked about before. I'm not sure what they're doing right now except twiddling their thumbs, but, you know, hey, got to start somewhere. So anyway, that's pretty much the end of my talk. He's got a question.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm not guaranteeing an answer.
Okay, earlier in the lecture you stated that the calculation speeds would be dramatically increased using quantum computational techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Just so I understand, you know, thinking like a 2-year-old here in this audience, are you saying that the calculation speeds would compress, say, for a given problem that would normally take thousands of years using classical computational techniques would now be compressed down to a few minutes?
It's, yes. And it's scary.
Yeah, it's real scary.
Scares the hell out of me. I didn't go as much into the... Actually, this talk came about because Scott saw me give more or less a similar talk at Freaknik conference up in Nashville, which is a hackathon that happens every October. There are flyers right there in case you're interested. And I talked a little bit more. I got a little bit more in depth up there about how how you operate on a set of qubits, and how you operate on a set of qubits and get an answer you're looking for out, which is the question, because you're looking at basically a random system. You're looking at a system which will give you certain values, but governed by probabilities randomly. And how do you get out what you want? Well, there are a couple of interesting things that people have come up with to isolate the correct answer from a question posed from input data. Because if you do an operation, say you do the searching operation once, basically all you've done is increase the probability that you'll measure the result you want by a couple of percent, maybe. And it depends on the number of qubits. If you have a number of qubits and probability is equally, and you have a number of states and the probability is equally distributed over those states, you'll measure those states according to their probabilities as you operate on them. The trick is to get it to a point where when you measure it, you have an overwhelming probability that you'll get to the right state. This is also something I didn't go into as much. It was the concept of a set of registers, of a register of qubits, 8 qubits, representing in a process, in a quantum computing process. The register doesn't get a number, and you operate on it, and you get another number. You operate on it, and you get another number.
Right. It just works linearly
That's a classical computation. You have a register. It holds a number. You operate on it, and you have another number. In a quantum computing method, you have a register that holds all the numbers
at the same time.
Every number possible that is possible of being represented with that number of qubits, it holds at the same time, all of those states. You operate on all of them with an operation that hits those qubits. And that's where the speed up comes. When you're able to exhaust a search by one operation versus
instantaneous.
To the N operations, you're moving from exponential time down to polynomial time in your calculations.
Why are we limited in our present bearskin and knives technology?
It's not bearskin and knives. All of computing these days really is based on quantum mechanics. All of the semiconductor technology in here started out in physics journals 40 years back. It's all based on quantum mechanics. The point is that it's not using the actual information calculation processes aren't necessarily using it.
But what limits us with the, I guess, the parallel approach then? I mean, why couldn't we apply that in a sort of a parallelistic quantization of the data going into, say, multiple processors?
You would have then all of these superposition of states, but you wouldn't have the entanglement necessarily between them. You would be able to represent. I didn't guarantee you an answer.
Sorry.
I think that's the crux of the answer is that you would maybe have a superposition, but you wouldn't have the entanglement, which is going to lead to the being able to process every state at the same time. You're not talking about the qubits themselves as representing the state of the system. You're talking about the qubits and their entanglement representing the state of the system.
So that creates an inherent data loss in the processing power. You actually lose a lot more of the basic fundamental data because of the parallel crossover interference?
Maybe yes, but only at the end. You're only throwing away at the end, at the very, very end of a calculation, what you don't want. You're looking, and that when you measure, well, I'm not sure if you're actually losing bits or not. You can't be. I don't think you're truly losing bits. I don't know. That's getting into information theory, and that makes my head hurt.
Sorry again. Okay. Anybody else have a question?
I'm just a physics geek.
Hope everybody ain't falling asleep.
You said you never thought that you would find a quantum processor in a regular laptop or desktop. Hmm. Why is that?
Basically, path of least resistance. This is easier right now. Maybe in the future. I honestly, In this case, especially if we're looking, if the research is being done in NMR, more than in silicon or gallium arsenide and quantum dots or quantum wires or something, we're looking at a long time before it begins to be meshed into our current computing industry. Like I said, but probably before vacuum tubes right now, or we're, you know, we've invented a vacuum tube, but we're not quite sure how to use it yet. I don't trust anything Bill Gates says.
Thank you.
Hey, I came in late. What atoms are they using?
For what? For
this sort of thing. It is a, it's an atom, or is
it's on a, yeah, it's on an atomic molecular electron scale. The materials involved depend on the process. What I call the hardware, which isn't really hardware, but it's the closest to analog. We have let's see if I can go back. We can talk. They're using NMR, which the atoms, their molecules they're using, I think they're some alcohol or, I think there's some fairly complex molecule like an alcohol or something that they're using in NMR. Ion trapping, they're looking at specific ions, and I'm not sure which ones. Optical cavity, QED, I'm not sure what they're putting in there either. But quantum dots, you're basically talking about your information carrier being an electron, and the electron being confined in an area where you can measure its state, which is a small quantum dot.
How are they measuring its state?
Light, magnetic fields. There are actually a couple of different ways to measure it. I don't know if they're using light. I don't think they are.
And how many different states does it have, do you know?
The electron, they worry about just having the two states, the spin-up, spin-down. That's basically it. They have a field, and they apply a field, and you have a spin-up or a spin-down that's in a measurable state. Let's see, what else? Oh, yeah, you can use light as well, but it's, from what I understand, more of a demonstration process, not all that applicable.
Okay. To maintain these molecules or atoms in the entangled state, isn't it necessary for like extreme cold to be used? I mean, to get like an appreciable time period?
It depends. It depends on.
I was hearing like sub liquid helium temperatures.
I know what you're talking about. Quantum dots are something I know the most about, but. It depends on how secure they are, where they are. Electron will interact with its environment, with phonons, with temperature. You basically worry about the quantity KT, you know, Boltzmann constant times temperature. If that gets high enough to knock an electron or whatnot out of its state, then you have issues. And yeah, I'm not sure if they're cooling down the NMR stuff. I imagine they are. Quantum dots, if you can get the confinement high enough and the fields high enough, you can work at room temperature with them. And that's one of the reasons they are, just because it's cheaper.
Like maybe the space inside of a supersized buckyball or something?
I'm not sure if they're using... I don't think they're using buckyballs at all, but that's actually too big for an electron. Most quantum dots are a couple of nanometers or a few 50 nanometers maybe. No, not nanometers, 50 angstroms or so is big. Anything else to puzzle me and perplex me? I'm impressed you all stayed. Wow.
Yeah, the buckyball question. Is there anything about molecular computing rather than quantum?
I have no idea. explain what you mean by that.
I don't know. I was just wondering, is there anything happening on the atomic, the molecular level?
Like still using the concept of classical mechanics, but in
right.
molecular, instead of the way semiconductors are working in another type of material like that? I have no idea.
Hmm.
Not really my field. I'm not sure about different technologies there. Anybody else? Is anyone working in molecular computing these days?
Just a comment. That 7-qubit quantum computer you had?
Yeah.
I believe that the algorithm they ran on that factored the number 15.
15?
Which I think is the record. They're
woohoo!
RSA algorithm encryption.
3 and 5. All right. Okay. Well, enjoy the con. Thank you.